Hi, everybody. It's Mel Barrett, the host of the In Between podcast. I wanted to give you a little bonus episode this week that I think you'll absolutely love. As I've mentioned in the past few episodes, I've been joining Rebecca Lavoie and sometimes Kevin Flynn from Crime Writers On for their hit show, The Readathon, where we discuss the daily goings-on in the retrial of Karen Reed. Rebecca's been covering this case for a long time, and they've got a library of 80-plus episodes covering all things Karen Reed, the drama that happens on the streets in the town of Canton, Massachusetts, and even town select meetings. Their coverage also includes interviews with Aidan Carney, a.k.a. Turtle Boy, commentary on the divide in the community, and a whole lot of laughs about some of the absurdity of this consequential case. I'll be joining Rebecca regularly to discuss the retrial, but wanted to give you a taste of what you're missing out on here on my general feed. Rebecca and Kevin have graciously offered up an episode to my listeners, so take a listen and stop by the Readathon and Crime Writers On to let them know I sent you. I'll put links in the show notes. For now, enjoy a recent episode I did with Rebecca called Jessica Hyde Continues Commonwealth's Defense of Jen McCabe. Enjoy.
Hello, this is the Readathon. And I am here with special guest Mel Barrett. Mel, do you want to remind everybody who you are?
My name is Mel Barrett. I am the host of the In Between podcast, which you can listen to wherever you get your podcasts. True crime.
That's right. And today we are going to be talking about, mainly we're going to be talking about day 11, Wednesday, May 7th. We're going to touch a little bit on yesterday because I didn't tape yesterday. And I know I have feelings. I especially want to apologize to you about my first impressions of a certain witness. You were right. I was wrong.
Oh, wow. I don't hear that very often.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So let's talk about today. We are going to get to the big witness today, I think, which was Jessica Hyde, Commonwealth forensic specialist, who's been hired for the last 2 years to do one job and one job only, which is to debunk the 227 search by Jen McCabe. Think about how wild that is. Hiring the Commonwealth, not using one of their many employees, hiring not one, but two forensic experts for the primary purpose. We'll get to why they disagree. Okay, so let's start at the beginning of today. We heard from a cop today, Connor Keefe. He is a state trooper who does not look like a thumb. It's kind of incredible, actually. He works at the Norfolk DA's office, and he was, I guess, a real rookie. As Proctor's text revealed that at least people thought of him that way. Those didn't come in today, but they were evoked. And he got on the stand today. He went to collect Carrie's phone from Carrie and Jen McCabe's phone from them. He opened a theatrical evidence bag and showed the shoe from 34 Fairview because he was there. And he also showed the court pieces of taillight from a paper bag. And I think it's important to remember the state police have never said who specifically found the taillight during the search. So I don't know if they wanted us to think it was this guy. Also, he said he didn't remember the Sarah Levinson interview, yet he was there. And I think the meat of his testimony, though, was about the autopsy. What did you think about that whole conversation about the autopsy he attended, not the lead investigator, Michael Proctor? He attended the autopsy of John O'Keefe with Scordy Bellow, the doctor for the Commonwealth. Thoughts?
Well, I think they gave him the shit jobs because he was the rookie. I think the reasons why he doesn't quite remember Sarah Levinson and things like that is because he just was sort of thrown into the mix to do things that they didn't feel like doing. I've got a dog in the room. Sorry.
That's fine. She's part of the podcast family.
She just came bursting into the room.
Ruby is part of our podcast family.
Yeah. So I think that sending the rookie in to observe the autopsy, he wouldn't be like interacting with Scordy Bellow.
Right.
Right. He wouldn't be turning her off. I think if Michael Proctor had gone in, he would have been pressuring. And that I think that Michael Proctor sets smart women off the moment they meet him.
You think so?
I do. I think that he is a tool. I think he's an asshole. I think that most smart women know that. And so I think that they were trying to bring the most, you know,
fresh-faced cutie.
Fresh-faced, someone who's not going to intervene, someone who's not going to ask a lot of questions. They can handle that outside of the autopsy, but somebody had to be there. Somebody had to do it. I mean, it's either that or Michael Proctor just doesn't like to be around dead bodies.
His testimony around the autopsy that was so weird. Yannetti's cross-examination is what was weird. Yannetti had to pull very basic information out from him, such as, where was Dr. Scordy Bellow looking when she performed the autopsy? I don't remember. Looking at the ceiling? No.
But what about all the objections, though, when he was asking, was she looking at his arm?
Right. Right.
Every time they started bringing up the scratches on the arm.
Yes.
Objection, objection, objection.
I think it's because the arm hasn't been entered into evidence yet formally. Keep in mind, we're on day 11 of a murder trial. The jury has not seen autopsy stuff. They have not seen any of the murder stuff, right? They haven't seen none of it. They've seen none of the murder stuff. They've seen none of the autopsy stuff. They've seen no crash reconstruction stuff. We're on day 11. I think it's important to note that. But yeah, he was pulling it up. But this is important. The him going to the autopsy is important. Him obfuscating is important. The obfuscation is always important because it makes the Commonwealth look like they're hiding something. But to let listeners know this, on 4/28/22, so in April, Michael Proctor had texts with Detective David DeChicco, or Trooper David
Vito.
DeChicco. Vito, yes. And basically, they were calling this guy, Keefe, a rookie move, not meeting with the ME and getting that homicide determination. And then Proctor says, Yuri and I had two conference calls with her and had numerous photos. We laid out the entire case for her. And this guy wouldn't even admit that he gave her, quote, input. We only told her the facts of the case. But yeah, so they were expecting him to go get that homicide designation. He didn't. And then they shit on him in a text thread about it.
Yeah, and I had two different thoughts about that. One was that, as far as Keefe is concerned, I'm not sure he was obfuscating on the stand because he didn't want to answer the questions. It was more about that he didn't want to align himself with Proctor. That's the way I read it. And then the other side of that is, when I first read that text from the group and it said rookie move, and the way that Proctor testified last time, it sounded like DeChicco was actually just giving him shit. Like, that's the way they talk to one another.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know if that was them calling Keefe a rookie or if that was really the case. They were just talking shit.
They were talking shit about the ME. This is the whack job thing. And then
but when
whack
he said
jobs,
rookie move.
Yeah, well, yeah, rookie
that's
move.
That's what I was thinking.
Just not getting her to get that. Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah.
Proctor now has been invoked, really, he's been invoked in little ways, but this was the first time we heard about him. Lead investigator Proctor.
Not by Hank Brennan.
In a significant way, right. It's almost like Hank Brennan is trying to pretend he doesn't exist. After Keefe testified, we had breaks and so forth.
Yeah.
There was a very interesting sidebar discussion that turned into a hearing, a spontaneous hearing. And this was a little bit complicated. In March of either this year or last year, I missed that which year, Jessica Hyde, who is one of the Commonwealth's forensic telephone experts, had a case in Maryland where she was basically considered unreliable to testify. Her testimony was deemed unreliable by a Daubert hearing because she did in that report, in that trial, did very much what she did today, which was kind of intimate that she was using Apple data. And she wasn't. She was using other tools. And they were basically like, she's using these as a surrogate. So she's not using Apple source code to find out stuff. She's using these tools as a surrogate. What Alessi was arguing was he didn't want her to eliminate her from testifying. He wanted to be able to question her on the fact that she was disqualified from testifying in this Maryland trial. He said it a bunch of case law. Of course, Bev was pissed. She says, this came in so late, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, no, this is a standard judicial hearing. This is standard. This happens during trials. And then Brennan's argument against this was the stupidest shit I have ever heard. He's accusing the defense of, quote, dehumanizing his witness. Thoughts?
The audacity for him to stand up there and say that they were dehumanizing when he literally just days ago was attacking Dr. Wolf, attacking and like belittling him on the stand. It was like uncomfortable to watch. And I think that's Hank's tactic, though. If he doesn't understand what's being said, because I think that's the bottom line. He doesn't understand the science the way that Alessi does. He doesn't understand the argument. He maybe doesn't even understand the case law in this case. I think his go-to is to attack them personally.
Yep. Ambush.
To make the
dehumanizing.
Judge feel something.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly
because
right.
Because it gets Bev all out of breath, and she makes calls in his favor.
That's
which
right.
Which she did today.
Which she did today. So today she decided that he could cross-examine her about these issues but not mention that trial. There was a funny little moment around Jessica Hyde, and I just want to say, for the record, people online are being sexist, anti-Semitic, and all sorts of stuff around Jessica Hyde. And that is not appropriate. It's not appropriate. She is a clearly, I mean, I'm making the assumption she's an Orthodox woman. She had her head covered. And then at one point, Brennan said she couldn't testify on Friday, which to me was like the big clue. He made it like real cagey, like it was a secret she couldn't testify Friday. But I've seen some shit online and it is not acceptable. It's not acceptable to talk about her looks. It's not acceptable to talk about her like physical voice. That being said, I do think what's fair game, because she's a paid witness for the Commonwealth, is to talk about her style of presentation on the stand of her own, of the Commonwealth's case, and then her style when she's being cross-examined. What do you think about this witness? Take everything else off the table. What is your objective observations about this witness?
I was annoyed as fuck. Mm-hmm. I was like, this woman, what it comes down to is, I mean, she's brilliant. She's so smart. She knows what she's talking about. She's a professor, not at Georgetown, like Hank Brennan said she was. She's at George Mason. So she teaches 100 students a year. She has the confidence in her knowledge and the confidence in her abilities. All that being said, the way that she completely turned herself to the jury and lectured them like they were 18-year-old freshmen.
That's right.
Well, first of all, I worked in the service industry for 15 years. And when she started describing how food was served at a restaurant, A, it told me she never worked at a restaurant. And B, I don't know what the hell she was talking about with pizza and databases. And
it made no sense. It made no sense.
Who sends pizza back? I mean, come on. And then who takes hot food out of a kitchen and puts it in a cold area to be picked up? So she lost me there. I mean, so those kind of things, I don't like being lectured to.
Yeah.
But to me, she came off as a hyper intelligent person, which is why I was looking forward to the cross, because that's the way I think of Alessi. Alessi, I was like, these two could like be in a relationship.
Mm.
Like they could, outside of this, they probably really would love each other. But Alessi has this sort of softness to him where he, even when he, you know, is getting really amped up, he has respect for the person that he's speaking to.
Yeah.
To me, she spoke to everyone, including the lawyers and the jury. The only one she had deference for was the judge. But otherwise, she was just talking down to everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone.
And I actually disagree with you on one point. I think she's definitely smart. I wouldn't call her brilliant. She is one of these smart people who won't acknowledge what they don't know. That was my impression. Whenever she was challenged on anything, it was like, well, that's your interpretation of the thing that's written right there that I wrote on that
theory.
Report. She had this, condescending, know-it-all-y thing, but she did this thing, and I always think of really smart people immediately acknowledge what they don't know, want to learn.
Alessi.
And that isn't this witness. And the most interesting thing to me about this witness is, you know, she says she used all these tools. She said blah, 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 blah. But she also said some things that, to my ear, were patently untrue. For instance, she did say, because he asked her the question, Brennan asked her the question about deleting searches. Scientific certainty. And she said, it's scientifically, sir, I have a degree of scientific certainty because there's no user interaction on the phone to delete individual searches. That is bullshit. I Googled it. How do you delete an individual search on Safari? Got the instructions and did it myself. I made a little video screen recording of my doing it. I will put it on the post for this show so you guys can watch it. It's easy as fuck to delete an individual search. So super easy. You open your Safari, you open the thing on the bottom, and then you can scroll through your searches, swipe right, and delete, swipe left. And keep in mind, people are like, oh, what she meant was she can't delete the inside tab data. I'm like, of course she can't. That's why we needed an extraction to find these searches, because they weren't just on the phone. That phone had to be extracted. So she was wrong about that. She also super fucked with the Commonwealth's timeline around steps and final movements of the phone. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, I'll explain it as best I can. What piqued my ears today, I don't want to get the times wrong. I don't remember if they're in our notes or not, but she basically said that John took, I think she said he took 80 steps at the time that they say he takes 84.
She said 1221 was when she
1221.
Took 1221. Really early.
Yeah. And, you know, when Alessi tried to bring it up to her, she was basically like, well, I didn't look at Whiffen's report. I don't really know. I'm just telling you what I did. I found a lot of positives for the defense, again, in her expert testimony. It seems to me like Brennan almost doesn't care. I think I said this to you the other day. He doesn't care that she just said 2 seconds earlier that she teaches at George Mason. And then he said, how long have you been at Georgetown?
Yeah.
Two very different schools.
I just think he's a dummy. I honestly just think he's a dummy. I really do.
I don't think he's a dummy.
Okay.
I don't. I think he's phoning it in.
Okay.
I think he's got this list of witnesses and he knows what questions he has to ask them. And he puts them up in whatever weird order that he's putting them up. He asks them the questions and he sits down. And then the defense tears them apart.
Yeah.
And then he gets up and he asks questions that still don't help him.
Right.
And then the defense gets back up and they tear him apart.
This is the thing. I have always believed that they arrived, John and Karen arrived at Fairview around like much earlier than the state's theory has them arriving. I've always thought
really?
That they
like
arrived
what time?
Like 12:20.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking I thought somewhere between 12:20, 12:25.
Yeah, 12:20. So yeah. So he took, according to her data, 80 steps over 3.2 minutes mm-hmm. at 12:21. And of course, she's mm-hmm. saying, yeah, but you can also get steps driving in your car, whatever. What's the most common way to get steps on your phone? Fucking walking. Everybody knows
right.
that. So I always thought they reached it there, that he went in the house and that she had plenty of time sitting outside before she drove away. I think she drove away at like 12:28 or something like that.
Well, she would have had to be at the house at 12:36.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a fact that nobody can get around.
No one disputes that fact. She was at John O'Keefe's house or within feet of John O'Keefe's house.
And went 150 to 300 feet.
Right. By 12:36, yep. It is a 7-minute drive, the fastest way to go. And there was a storm. So I always think she left 12:27, 12:28. This case, the prosecution has her hitting him at 12:31, okay? And then there's movement on his phone, like whatever it was, fucking movement. But what she said is that the final movement on his phone was for 20 seconds, and it was from 12:31 and seconds to 12:32 and seconds. It was 20 seconds. And when she answered that question and said that to Brennan, he went, ugh. It was yeah. a wild moment. It was a totally, it was like.
But how did he not know that?
She's written several reports for the Commonwealth. I don't know
for
how he
him.
Didn't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't understand.
I don't know either. What Alessi did, I think Alessi did make a tactical error crossing her, in my opinion. In my opinion, he focused too much on tiny specific mistakes in her report rather than
yeah.
going in first with big stuff.
Right.
He closed with, is Apple the most reliable data yet? He should have started there. He should have started with the preservation of the phone stuff, because that was the most interesting stuff to me, that and her mm-hmm. timestamps. So just to talk about that, she brought two things into play that we have been talking about. She
yes.
brought in the word Faraday bag.
And airplane mode.
And she also brought in biometric activation of phones. She mm-hmm. brought in all three of those things. Now, in terms of biometric activation, she was basically saying that you could use a dead person to start a phone. By the way, you can't do that with their finger, like she said. You haven't been able to do that since like 2013 or ish,
mm-hmm.
Because it uses electrical pulse too from your finger. So you actually can't do that. So she's wrong about it. So she's basically saying
unless
things that are wrong.
Alive.
Yeah. So she's saying things that are like on their face wrong. And like, I'm just like, is no one going to correct her? Anyway, so she brought those three things into play. And those three things all fit with shit we've talked about. Airplane mode will track health data, but it won't track location data. It's the only
right.
thing it will track is health data. And then she basically said how one could open a phone if they weren't John O'Keefe, which is
right.
to use his biometrics to open a phone. I have long thought that if his phone wasn't open when he was punched, hit his head, whatever, that Brian Albert or Brian Higgins, who are both high-level law enforcement agents who know how to fucking do this with phones because they take phones from mm-hmm. suspects all the time, probably put his phone in airplane mode or, like we said the other day, put it in a Faraday bag. And she put those three things on the table. So those words have been defined now for
yeah.
the jury. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I was, as soon as she said Faraday and airplane mode, I texted you and was like, Faraday, Faraday. One of the things that I didn't quite understand, though, was that she said if the phone is moving, even if it's in a Faraday bag, it would still be location would still be recorded.
Location
is
would be off. You could turn it off and turn it back on. There's lots of things you could do.
I think one of the most important things she said was that the phone was not in a Faraday bag, though.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't
in
a Faraday
that.
Bag after they collected it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I agree with your theory. I mean, the more I think about it, Brian going back to the police station at the time that he did making a phone call, he was getting something.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too.
And it has to be a Faraday bag.
It could be, yeah.
But can I just say my opinion about... So I've been thinking about this a lot today. We're spending all of this time on this 227. So there's a lot of things.
So much time.
And we ended the day with a video that directly impacts what I'm about to say, which we'll get into later. My thoughts have been that if Jen McCabe made this search, then case over. But if she didn't make this search, it still doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
And at the end of the day, I feel like we're focusing a little too much on this because there is one woman on trial.
Mm-hmm.
And whether she made this search or not, I know it's important. I know that how important it is. I know that
it's
makes
a case killer.
Case.
It's a case killer.
It is.
Yeah.
Which is why they're focusing on it. But the thing is, the defense can kill this, whether it's true or not. So that reasonable doubt thing can happen with this 227, which is why I think I'm so confused that Brennan is using two different experts.
He keeps bringing it up.
Really hammering this point home because it's so easy to put reasonable doubt into it.
Right.
And then my other thought is, if I were sitting on this jury, what I have heard so far, I understood some of the tech, you know, speak that happened today and from within. But if I'm sitting on this jury, the only thing that is important to me, the thing that wipes out everything they did in their reports, is that nobody has the Apple proprietary information.
Right.
So these are all opinions, and there is no solid answer to this question.
That's right. That's right.
And none of these experts can say that there is, because unless they work for Apple and are able to testify, but they're not, they can't testify to what Apple does. There is no way to answer this unless they bring Apple in.
That's right.
And Apple's not coming in.
Nope.
So at the end of the day, the question, I don't need to hear from these experts.
No. I would just say they should have presented it once with Whiffen and then let it go and then let the defense put on their witness, cross-examine the fuck out of that witness. And the Commonwealth is making really a big deal out of this. And they're giving the defense so many opportunities to punch holes in it.
He started in his opening statement, though. He said the data is on our side. The data, that one statement in his opening, he has been wrong about every single day since this trial started.
Yes. So I watched Sue O'Connell's Twitter thread. I have like several tabs open when I'm watching the trial that I keep on my side computer. And I just refresh her thread because her jury breakdown to me is very interesting.
Yeah.
And she said that the jury was kind of bored during this Alessi minutia cross-examination. But then they perked up when Whiffen came up. Because some of the things that she said today contradicted things that Whiffen said. And she said two jurors looked at each other, smiled, and wrote in their notebooks at one point. Yeah. And the thing that's interesting that she also did in her report, she was clearly a prosecution witness, and she denied tailoring her report to help them, which, by the way, is her fucking job. She should have just said, I did what they asked me to do, period. They hired me. They paid me. I did my analysis. I wrote a report. I gave them the report. But she didn't include call durations on Jen McCabe's phone between like midnight and 8 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
She did, however, confirm the 507 phone call to Nicole. She confirmed that that happened. And he was like, but you left out the duration of that call. But she confirmed that that call happened. And that's, to me, the most damning pieces of evidence that have come in so far are the text chat and the 507 phone call, to me, are the two most damning things that have come in so far. So that's interesting that, you know, I think the jury, I think they're uninterested because they don't think it matters, maybe, this minutia, if she spelled a word wrong, put a period wrong kind of stuff.
Or the UTC, the difference between UTC and
Eastern Standard
blah, blah, blah.
Time.
I was
yeah.
like, really? Come on, Alessi. But I have a question for you, actually. I've been hearing about this a lot the past few days. I keep hearing the jury is young.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? How does that affect things? Especially with these tech witnesses.
Yeah. If the jury is young, they are iPhone owners, right? And they are not going to follow the rules about not investigating what their phone can do. They are probably going to see if their phone recorded steps while they were driving. They're probably going to check that. I mean, because they could just be saying they're checking it for any reason. You know, it doesn't have to be for this case. They could literally say, I check my steps every day. I'm assuming that some are going to do that. They all have a lot of lived experience with phones. And if they're young, some of these old men, expert witnesses, like that weather dude that we'll talk about, probably wouldn't resonate with them because younger people are all about what's my lived experience, right? They're like, I've lived through blizzards. You don't have to tell me it's cold during a blizzard. And that's what that whole weather lesson felt like. So what do you think of the fact that they're young, if in fact they're young?
I think it's interesting. I think that if by young, that's anyone under the age of 40 is what I would say.
Or 50 maybe. In public radio, we would call anyone under 55 young, just FYI.
Okay. I keep hearing the jury is young. I don't know what that means, but I do know that anybody who came from Gen X on has been living with this technology for a very long time because we have, you know, two teenage girls in the house. When I was thinking about the meteorologist, I was thinking of my 16-year-old being like, oh, he's so cute.
Yeah.
Like, they love old people.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, maybe some of the jurors were like, oh, this sweet guy, you know, the way he described, well, we'll get into it. But yeah, so I think that there's probably going to be more affinity for softer, older people. And there might even be some affinity for Hyde because she is of that generation that is, I mean, she's probably, I don't want to guess at her. Well, I guess I will guess at her age. If I looked at her, I would think that she's probably in her late 30s.
I would think early 30s, tops.
Okay.
She looks young. She looks young.
She looked really young. The way she spoke was very young.
Yes.
Her vernacular.
Even her attempts to be professional sounded like junior varsity attempts to be professional. Not like,
absolutely.
You know, oh, I'm sorry. Let me explain that to you. Let me go back a little bit. Like, she sounded like she was in a play about being professional.
Right.
Not like
exactly.
She, you know, I mean, she didn't have a lot of experience in that realm.
So I think that if the jury's young, they're either going to identify with her or they're going to be completely annoyed with her.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. If I were sitting on the jury, I would have been completely annoyed with her.
And there also is misogyny is a thing. That is a factor in this case. It is a factor that she is a woman and that also she was a know-it-all, which is not because she's a woman, by the way, to be very clear.
No.
But the fact that she's a woman will put words like that in the jurors' minds without her even talking sometimes. Like, that's just how people are. Women have internalized misogyny about other women. That's a thing we know.
And I also think if the jury is young, they're still of that area. So do they fall into that sort of what we've talked about before, the sort of
blue collar conservative,
line, blue collar?
Yep.
Are they those kids that voted for Trump or are they more liberal? Are they, if they're more liberal, then are they looking, do they have the ideas about cops in their heads?
Mm-hmm.
And are they annoyed with all those cops that are taking the stand and acting like they did nothing wrong when
mm-hmm.
it's really easy to see they did a lot of things wrong?
Yep.
Or are they on the side of sort of, but it's different now because the Trump voter, I really don't want to go down the road of Trump voter, but that's the only thing I can think to use right now. The Trump voter isn't necessarily backing the blue so much anymore.
Right. Right.
So where do these people fall if they come from that area and they're young?
The people who amplify all my pro Karen Reed tweets, like a lot of them or most of them have MAGA in their handle, like descriptions.
Crazy.
And I'm
crazy.
Like, this is what I love about this case is it's bringing people
yeah,
together.
Me too.
Can I just talk about one detail about something else Jessica Hyde said that I can't believe Alessi didn't address? This has actually pissed mm-hmm. me off. She claimed that the reason those phone calls were deleted on Jen McCabe's phone data was because the data only stores 200 calls at a time. And the 29th, she made more than 200 calls. So the calls she would have made before, which is wild, the calls
crazy.
She would have made before that would have been deleted. The problem is she has two non-deleted calls at 12:14 and 12:18 a.m. before the missed calls she had to John O'Keefe and all that stuff. Those were all deleted. But she has successful calls before that. So this whole, it only holds 200 phone calls thing.
The sound effects. So she originally called John. He didn't answer when they were in the car on the way over. And then John called her back. And that was when they were lost.
12:18. Yes.
12:18.
And that confirms my 12:21 arrival time, by the way, because it was very close to the house.
But if I get into Jen McCabe's head, which I don't really want to do, those are the calls she doesn't delete, of course.
Right. Right.
She's helping John.
Right. All right. So let's talk about yesterday, shall we?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yes, please.
I am very sorry. I was wrong. I said that Gallagher was hapless, that he seemed fine, but he was out of his depth. No. It turns out that Paul Gallagher, who retired from the Canton Police in August of just the last year, just a few months ago, was the highest paid town employee in Canton, Massachusetts, literally more than anybody else in the whole town.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't even the head of the police, right? He made $322,000 a year. His insistence that this investigation was good drove me fucking wild. Is not getting the Arlo camera from the neighbor who happens to be his boss and him correcting his cross-examiner about the fact that it's not Ring. It's not a Ring camera. It's an Arlo camera. It was the stupidest thing.
Who gives a fuck? Yeah.
You know, because he didn't get the camera because he knows for a fact it's directed at 32 Fairview, not 34 Fairview. So it doesn't pick 34 Fairview. And he knows that because I've picked up a package there and my boss has showed me a still shot of my doing it. Horrible, 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 horrible. He's friends with Higgins. They've been friends since 2018. And they socialize. They have drinks together. They're not casual friends. They are friends' friends. He found out within 24 hours the, quote, list of narratives of officers involved. He is another one of these guys who will only talk about facts, having not made any assumptions. And mm-hmm. then he talked about going in the house and not talking to anyone, looking around, nothing. He had a conversation with Brian Albert in the little breezeway.
Breezeway. Yep.
Never went in. And as somebody pointed out yesterday, a lawyer, you didn't actually need a search warrant to even walk through the house to do a well-being check because there was a dead person on the lawn. Mm-hmm. But he insists. To me, this would be much more credible to the jury if he said, you know what? In retrospect, I think it would give you peace if I had, so I wish I had. Like, that's mm-hmm. the thing I would say. I would say, I didn't even realize this would be an issue in this case. If I had known that, I 100% would have checked out the house. I'm kind of sorry I didn't. I think that would be an answer that the jury could buy and would make him mm-hmm. seem better. But this obfuscation, this pushback, fucking obnoxious. Thoughts?
Lots of thoughts. There was one thing that you did not mention in your breakdown of the things that he said yesterday. And one of the biggest things that stuck out to me, their best detective, Kevin Albert.
Their very best detective.
Was the reason why they had to recuse themselves. And even when he was crossed and I think it was Kevin Albert, your best detective, who was disciplined for drinking in his cruiser and losing his gun, you stand by that? And he's like, oh, he's an excellent detective. Excellent. Like, can't even give an inch on that. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I agree. He frustrated me so much. I started seeing it on day one with him. It was kind of subtle. He was just defending the police. Mm-hmm. He was defending the police. And I'll be honest with you. I think part of it's ego. I think part of it is that there's been a lot of backlash toward the police in this country, but also specifically in this state and in this area for a while now. And I think I don't want to say all cops, but cops like him or detectives like him are in this constant state of having to defend themselves with everything they do.
Yeah.
I think it's his baseline now. This is heightening it. And it's the idea that you're the kind of person who does something wrong and can't admit it because of your ego. I don't remember what that's called in psychology, but you are that person. So he's in this state right now, and he's really on the hot seat. And I don't remember him much from the last trial, but boy, is he important. I didn't realize how important he is.
He's very important.
And here's a couple of things that I wanted to bring up.
He used the leaf blower, which we saw a video of. Very important.
The leaf blower and the video. I am pissed that the defense didn't push on that leaf blower video. I can see you blowing stuff around. Imagine what's blowing around that you can't see.
Right.
That is forensic. Hair. Anything like that. And then on top of that, why did they not hammer the point home that they had the meteorologist saying, here's how much snowfall had happened at this point in time, 8 o'clock in the morning. It should have only been about that much snow at 8 o'clock in the morning. 2 inches? I'm not, the audience can't
like
see me.
3 something.
2 inches. Yeah. 3 inches of, even if it was 5 inches of snow.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of snow that he was standing on, the crime scene that he was standing on and tromping around in and packing the snow in even more, was way more snow than the meteorologist was saying was there. So I would actually question when that video was shot. I think that video was shot later on in the day.
Interesting.
I think it happened.
It could have been a drift, though, to be fair. It could have been a windy drift where the snow was deeper. That happens.
It could have been.
Like, the snow on my front lawn is a lot deeper than it's actually gone, because the plow comes by, yeah. They throw snow everywhere, and then it drifts up with wind.
So where John's body was, there you could see grass still. And that's one of the things where I'm like, I don't know what the snow was at this point.
Right.
You can still see the grass. You can see him blowing everything around. But he's standing on a mound of snow right next to where John's body was. And regardless, you know, that was my first instinct was, when was this video actually shot?
Right.
And then my second part was, he is literally standing on evidence.
Yes.
He is trudging
his
dirty ass
boots. But he didn't
know
it was a crime
scene
at the time, even though he was collecting evidence. He didn't know it was a crime scene.
They made it a brilliant point today, though, when they were like, so you went out and you got a leaf blower. You didn't think to bring, like, I don't know, heat lamps?
Yeah.
Melt the snow? Don't blow the snow, buddy. And then for him to be like, oh yeah, it was perfect. That's that leaf blower, I'm going to use it again. It was great.
I think that stuff resonated with the jury, the bad investigation stuff. Can you talk about, I didn't really get the significance of this. You did right away. He showed Gallagher, AJ showed Gallagher a photo of the back of the Lexus in the Sally Port in Canton.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And next to the Lexus, there was like a paper towel on the ground and like some cups, right?
Yes.
Can you talk about the significance of that?
Yeah, my immediate reaction, and this is probably just my conspiracy brain going into overdrive watching all this stuff, but when he showed that picture to the jury and to the rest of us, so I'll describe it for the audience. It was basically the lower part, passenger side of the Lexus. So all you could see was the lower bumper and the tire. Next to it was the Stop and Shop bag with all of the Solo cups inside.
Not in an evidence locker.
Not in an evidence locker, and wide open to the air of the Sally Port. Oil, gasoline, sweat, dirt, mud, snow, everything, just particles all over in the air falling into that bag.
But because they had already decided what happened and they weren't going to need his blood for anything.
And, you know, I think they really hammered that point home with his testimony and with Jen's testimony. Everybody had decided what happened, so they stopped investigating. That's such a good point. But in this picture, the thing that stood out to me and that the defense kept pointing out, there was a paper towel on the ground. My instinct, my first thought was they used it to either wipe evidence off of the Lexus or put evidence on the Lexus. Mm. They found 5 different DNA profiles on the bumper of the Lexus, 5 different men. Did it come from those Solo cups?
It could have come from holding onto the Lexus while you're using the paper towel to pull some plastic out of the thingy.
Could have. That's the other thing. If they had used that paper towel to cover their hands, to pull the Lexus. I mean, and then it goes back to that other picture they showed us, which was the first time I'd seen that photo. I guess it was in the last trial, but it's when they drive over to Karen's parents' house.
No, it's to John O'Keefe's house on Meadows, and her car is in the driveway. And this is a bad looking piece of evidence for her because it looks like when they drive up, it looks like that taillight is not cracked. It looks like it's missing. You know, you can't tell from the angle where it is how much the taillight's damaged, but it looks, you can see damage on that right taillight.
You can, but I think I saw that differently.
Yeah.
That's why it was so important to me, that photo, when they pull into the driveway to John's house and her car is sitting there. I saw snow covering the whole top part of the taillight and just a small piece on the bottom.
Okay, yeah.
I mean,
I
saw.
It could be that, but I saw just damage and I was just like,
yeah.
And I think that the defense should compare these images to one another. But when the jury only sees one image, you know, it's like broken taillight. So that's what I thought about it. But,
well, they found another piece of broken taillight just today.
I know. In the bag. Who knows? It may have broken off the first piece.
Yannetti made a big deal about entering that into evidence,
I know,
too.
I know.
That was interesting.
So let's talk about another witness yesterday, the meteorologist. We've talked about him a little bit. Cute old guy. Love talking about the job of meteorology and what it means.
He loves it.
And
he loves it.
I don't think he was in any way offensive. But he was giving the timeline of snow. It didn't really seem to match up with the timeline of snow that the prosecution wants us to have. He talked about the visibility being fine, which does not match up with all the stories that the prosecution has. And, you know, he described the phases of the snowstorm as small enough to, quote, track a cat. And they just kept using that expression.
That was my favorite.
Really funny. So what were your impressions of this meteorologist?
You know, I thought he was cute. I thought, you know, here's a guy who's just spent his entire, like, his obsession is the weather. And then my immediate thought was, I hope he doesn't lose his job, you know, because they're cutting so much. He was only there to tell us that the ground was hard.
Yep.
You know, and I felt really bad about that. But he told us a lot more than I expected. He told us that at the time they found John, there was 3.9 inches of snow on the ground.
Yes.
The first search, which happened at, that's what I was saying about Gallagher. The first search happened at 8 a.m. There was only supposed to be 4 inches of snow on the ground.
Yes.
By the time they found the taillight pieces, there was 8 inches of snow on the ground.
Right.
So why didn't they see the taillight at 4 inches of snow on the ground?
They should have, because those pieces
around
like, that
John.
One piece is like a plate.
Yeah.
The one piece that we said, always that famous picture of Proctor holding, it's like a salad plate sized. It's big. It's not like a tiny little shard, if anyone's wondering. It's like the size of a dessert. Yeah, I thought that was interesting, too.
The only other thing with that witness, his name was what? Gilman.
Yep. Yeah.
Robert Gilman?
Yes.
He did make another point to say that at 12:45, which is the time they keep using, 12:30, whatever it might have been, there wasn't enough that you could track a cat. That's when he said you could track the cat.
It was a dusting.
It was a dusting, which would mean Did Jen McCabe see those tracks in the street at the time she said she did?
Well, Ryan disputes that there was any snow on the road at that time. And I will tell you, as a New Englander, when it first starts snowing, it doesn't matter how cold it is, there is some warmth in the asphalt from having soaked up the sun during the day.
Well, and they also pre-salt.
Yes. And so the road is the last thing to get snow. You get it on your grass first, your roof, your patio furniture. The last thing to get snow on it is the road. So it makes sense that there wouldn't be snow on the road at that time.
Right.
All right. So let's move on quickly. Guarino testified yesterday.
He played
out loud the Karen Reed, John, I fucking hate you. You're a pervert, blah, blah, blah voicemails, which we've all heard before. And I think proved that she didn't hit him, but whatever.
Absolutely.
But the interesting part about that was they did not cross-examine Guarino at this point. Thoughts?
I don't think they cross-examined him for the exact reason you and I are sitting here talking about this. This is the first time that I've seen them, and maybe I missed it in the last trial. He went through the entire timeline where he would say, I even wrote it down. He would be like 12:37 voicemail and it's John, I fucking hate you. And then it's 12:41 voicemail. Could be a butt dial.
But it was a voicemail.
Only 1 second long. Text at 12:55. See you later. 12:59. Call. No answer. And then it goes into 1:12. No answer. 1:13. No answer. 1:14. 1:16. 1:17. There were a couple of times where it was like 5:28. No answer. 5:28 and some odd milliseconds, whatever. No answer. She would call him three times in 1 minute.
Yeah.
I actually decided to tell like a personal story on my podcast this week going into these voicemails or getting ready to go into these voicemails because I've been in this position. I've been where Karen was, not necessarily drunk. I wasn't drunk at all. I was in a place where I didn't trust my partner and also thought she could have been in a place of danger. And I started getting frenetic because she would not return my calls. She wouldn't read my texts. I didn't know where she was. I thought she had hurt herself.
Yeah.
And I went crazy until the point where I drove out to where she last was and got a cop involved, only to find out that, you know, she was cheating on me, which is another story. But my point is that if I'm sitting on this jury, and I think most women sitting on this jury, I'll say women because I don't want to be sexist here, but I don't often hear stories of men unless they are predatory or abusive acting in this way. But for women, it's always to me a sign of, you know, they're anxious, they're frenetic, they're trying to figure out what's going on. And the only tool they have to do that is this phone.
That's right.
And that's what she was doing. And that's why the defense left it alone. Because if you sit there and watch this guy read out all these texts and these phone calls, and you hear these intermittent voicemails, including the one that says, no one knows where you are, it means I'm lying at this point to get you to call me back.
That's right.
And
she thought he
was
cheating on her. She thought he was with another woman, period. She said she indicates as much on a voicemail. She calls him a pervert. I'm here with your niece, you fucking pervert. She thinks that he is fucking somebody and that she is home with his kid and she's fucking pissed about it. And she's incredibly anxious. Like those things are true.
I think that any person on the jury, male or female, is going to hear those voicemails. Their instinct is not going to be like, wow, she just killed somebody and now she's calling him and telling him
especially
he's a fucking
pervert.
Especially if they're young.
Drama.
And especially if they're women. And since the jury is split down the middle, women and men.
Well, if they watch Bravo, any show on Bravo, this is like normal girlfriend behavior, right? All right.
Well,
we talked about Charles Ray. He was the cop who went to do the wellness check and we ended up getting his dash cam video of him pulling in the driveway behind Karen's car. So then it was Kevin O'Hara, who is a CERT member, the search team member at the scene at 34 Fairview. He shifted his most of his testimony was the same as last trial, but he shifted the time the CERT team started their search. I believe last year was something like 5:41 and he put it in the 5:20s. And he shifted it to sort of that sort of in his mind, maybe debunks the story that they waited for the final CERT team member to get there before starting the search. And of course, the theory is that the final person who arrived is the one who brought the taillight pieces. So he kind of bunked that. And then you said when AJ crossed him, he was a bumbling mess. Do you want to talk about that?
I don't know what happened with him. He kept apologizing too. He knew, like he was aware that he was doing it. At the beginning, I was like, oh, he's kind of fumbling here. This is weird. He keeps asking questions with the wrong info in them. And it was making the detective look like he was smarter than Jackson at that point.
Which is rare.
Because the detective was like, what are you talking about? You know? And he was really struggling, it seemed like. It was very strange. There was no reason for it. He just kept screwing up his words and details.
Yeah.
And then he kept apologizing. He did say it's been a long day.
Maybe he was hungry.
Maybe he had low blood sugar.
I get real stupid when I'm hungry.
There was one more thing with O'Hara's cross that I found interesting.
Yeah.
At the very end of the questioning from Jackson before the redirect, a piece of information came out. I don't know if it was in last trial, but he established that someone wearing a hoodie came out the side door of 34 Fairview and watched the search.
It was Brian. Had to be
Brian. It was Brian or Colin or Kevin.
I don't think Colin was in the house at that point, but it could have been Brian Jr., but I think it was Brian.
Yeah, but then I was thinking about the video that you sent me where Colin and Kevin or Chris were following that guy all around Canton.
Yeah, Colin and Chris.
And Colin had a hoodie, like a gray hoodie on. And
he
was
does love
to,
a hoodie.
He always wears a hoodie.
Yeah, I think they love hoodies and hats. I think that's why they're all bald, because they keep their scalps covered all the time. They don't get any oxygen. Yeah. It's like the golfer syndrome, like golfers who wear visors have lush hair, and the ones who wear hats all the time have no hair. By the way, I don't hate a bald man. I just have noticed a pattern that all these cops, a lot of them anyway, are bald.
You said pattern.
They look like thumbs.
Which is bald pattern.
I know.
Pattern baldness.
Finally, Brennan had a real fucking audacity moment in his redirect where he talked about the best practices of photos and video would be to establish and keep the metadata. Why is that in a fucking audacity moment?
Because they destroyed the metadata on all of the Canton Police Department videos. And that was after the defense had, they had agreed to work with the defense. The defense sent one of their expert witnesses out to collect the metadata. And Colleen Crawford, or someone in the department, destroyed basically all the metadata by transferring all of the files over to a cloud or hard drive.
Not all the files.
That's true. Which the expert said they could, if they didn't, to not lose the metadata, they should not transfer anything. And so what did they do? They did it immediately. And then when the expert showed up, there was no metadata. And Bev ruled against the defense, basically, like, you don't need it. You got everything you need. Well, they transferred it for you. They put the files on a, like, these people don't understand. Like, I'm not a techie person, but I know there's metadata in everything I do.
That's right.
And create. And the fact that Bev, because she is not knowledgeable about that, she doesn't think it's a big deal. So the audacity of Hank to be like,
yeah,
well, the best practices is to have a timestamp and to keep metadata and blah, blah.
No shit.
All pics and vids. Yeah. Yeah, really?
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, I will say, somebody asked me to share my observation about Bev, and I won't go into it too much. I don't see, and I know that there's theories that she's on the McAlbert side. It's just very hard for me to go there. I mean, she's fucking judge, right? I don't believe that. I mean, she might know. We know that her husband defended Chris Albert. We know there are connections there. It's not an issue.
Yeah, sure.
But she's a judge. It's hard for me to go there. I see fatigue and cognitive decline of some kind.
I agree.
Like, I'm in menopause now, and before I started taking estrogen, I was fucking stupid. It could be that, but I see fatigue, cognitive decline of some kind. I don't want to, like, diagnose her with anything. I could be completely wrong, but she just seems exhausted by life right now, low energy, not paying attention, and this lack of ability to keep details, remember what she said, like, hours before she said it or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's what I see. I do see a lot of bias in the courtroom, and I think that plays in to this because, you know, a judge's earlier instincts on the bench is to be prosecution friendly. Like, they all work in the same building. Like, they all know each other, right? But I think she's taken it to a level where she's not checking herself the way she probably would have at the peak of her career. So that's what I see.
This isn't about Bev's demeanor in the court, but I feel like today and yesterday solidified the fact that if the defense loses this case, which I don't think they're going to, I think today and yesterday established the strongest appeal for them. That is because Bev would not allow them to have the FBI expert witness that was going to explain proper crime scene investigation and proper police investigation to this jury. And we've got 2, 3, 4 police officers and detectives and Massachusetts State Police sitting on the stand telling us that what the layperson and anyone who's watched CSI knows is a bad investigation. And they are telling us, no, this is the right way to do it. This is the right way. So you've got a jury sitting here going, well, I've got cops telling me this is the right way, even though my instinct tells me this is probably not the right way. And the reasoning for turning down that expert witness for the defense was that the jury understands how crime scenes work and investigations work.
Right, right. Which was a terrible.
They can appeal. today.
Yeah. I agree. I agree. Yeah. That was an appealable error. I really, really do.
Yeah.
Well, tomorrow, I think we might get our Ukrainian friend, Yuri Bukhanyk.
Yuri.
I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait. Mm. So if we're going to get Bukhanyk again, we're probably not going to get murder stuff, right? We're going to get other stuff. But Bukhanyk is a fascinating character to me. He's the one who keeps showing up at old ladies' houses and giving them
shit
for writing stuff on the internet. He's a scary dude. I think Bukhanyk and Tully are pretty scary dudes. And I think that he is, the fact that he keeps showing up again and again and again and again and again in all these things, I'm looking forward to seeing him testify.
I think Tully, Bukhanyk, and Brian Albert are the scariest three dudes.
100%.
Tully has his fingers in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't figure out what it is. He's there. He's everywhere. His fingerprints are all over this. But I can't figure out what he's doing exactly.
He's at every witness meeting. He's at every single Commonwealth witness has placed him at their meetings with the prosecutor. Every single one.
And you know what's interesting is that I can't picture his face in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that he's like flying below the radar.
I guarantee he's bald.
But yeah, Yuri Bukhanyk, when I saw those videos of him and Tully, I think it was, going up to that woman, that older woman's house and harassing her, harassing everybody. How they harassed that older dude over the ducks, the guy with
Canton
the
fence guy,
the Canton fence guy, that bothered me so much. And it freaks me out because we're moving into a place in this country where cops are going to have more freedom to sort of get away with this kind
of stuff. Less accountability. Yep.
And I'm really kind of scared about people like Yuri Bukhanyk and Tully and Brian Albert.
100%. 100%. All right. Well, if we get Bukhanyk, I know we're going to be texting about it tomorrow, and then we can talk about it next time you're on the show. Thank you so much, Mel, for joining me on the Readathon for such a meaty one with so many people to talk about.
I know. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I love it.
In crime media.